You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter in today for Rob Ferret. State lawmakers are working to pass a bill to expand access to emergency mental health care in Wisconsin. The bipartisan effort would set up more regional mental health crisis centers in the state, which currently has limited options for patients. It often means an hours-long trip to a state facility in Winnebago. During a Senate committee hearing last week, 22-year-old Kirsta Lind of Neenah told her story of a recent mental health crisis and where the current system in Wisconsin fell short for her.
I didn't need to be on a 72-hour hold. I'd been hospitalized 5 times before that and then had never once left the hospital against medical advice. And the hold just made things so much worse. They handcuffed me, put me in the back of the police car, and drove me to the hospital like a criminal.
The bill would create a framework for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services to certify and fund more crisis centers in the state so patients can receive better treatment closer to home. Today, we're talking to a lawmaker on each side of the aisle involved with this legislation, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How would additional mental health care facilities around the state affect you? Do you want to see more efforts like this from the state legislature? If you're willing to share, have you or a loved one dealt with an acute mental health issue? What was missing in that moment? What would have been helpful? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Clint Moses is a Republican state representative from Menominee who represents the 29th Assembly District. He's one of the lead authors on this bill. I spoke with him earlier today. So as I understand it, this bill wouldn't be building brand new facilities, but certifying and funding existing centers. Can you walk us through the nuts and bolts of how this would work?
Yeah, and there's actually a little bit of both on it. There's a lot that we left up to Department of Health Services for rulemaking. But yeah, we're looking to utilize facilities that are already in existence. There's a couple sites that I've kind of eyed up in my part of the state in western Wisconsin, in St. Croix and Dunn County. But the idea is to try and get it so that we're not having to transport people with mental health crisis clear across the state to Winnebago. And we're trying to set up, eventually, I'd like to have at least 5 centers. So one per DHS, Department of Health Services District in the state.
And I'm curious, what led you personally to get involved in this issue and put this bill together?
You know, I've heard about this long before I was elected. Actually, this whole process started back in 2009. When DHS Wisconsin Public Mental Health Substance Abuse Infrastructure Study was done. I know it's a lot of words, but they identified a need for it back in 2009. Many predecessors from Western Wisconsin had worked on similar projects to this. This funding was actually allocated by Joint Committee on Finance last session and simply was not utilized because DHS was not given, in my opinion, a good roadmap to follow as to how you best utilize this money.
Yeah, let's talk about that funding. How much money is attached to this bill and how would it be used?
As it currently sits, it's $10 million. And I know that sounds like a lot, but when you're trying to do these types of things, basically these facilities would be relatively small, but they're pretty labor intensive. They're going to be pretty heavily staffed with human service, mental health professionals, obviously some law enforcement for security. We're looking at facilities that are going to be at the largest 15 beds. And like I said before, 5 of them eventually across the state. The bill as written clarifies that the first facility needs to be located somewhere in western Wisconsin. So it could be up in my area, up in the northwest, or it could be in the southwest. The Senate lead on this, Howard Markline, obviously he'd like to see southwest and I'd like to see northwest. But the idea is to get the ball rolling with at least a facility. I think the success of these facilities is going to spawn more of them, more facilities regionally. We don't need one in every single community, but we need one that's within an hour driving distance, ideally, for across the state.
As you mentioned, the Winnebago Mental Health Institute is the place where a lot of people have to go when they're experiencing a mental health crisis. Can you lay out a bit more of a vision of how and when you see these facilities coming into play? How would they be utilized?
Well, quite frankly, what happens now is when a person has a mental health crisis, usually the local sheriff's department in our counties has to deal with the situation and transport them clear across the state to Winnebago. So in some instances, like I've talked to many people, and you'd ask before why I got interested in this. Well, before I was elected, I have a lot of friends, patients, and I am a chiropractor, so I still see daily public and talk to a lot of people behind closed doors. And this is an issue that's been identified for quite some time. But in my part of the state, you're giving up a whole shift for law enforcement to make their way down to Winnebago to stay with the patient until they've been checked in and then head back to their communities. So you're taking law enforcement out of the communities for at least a shift. On average, it's anywhere from 10 to 15 hours is what the typical trip down to Winnebago is for law enforcement up in Northwest Wisconsin. And then not only does that cost time, money, and take the law enforcement out, but think about the person in crisis. You take them and you detain them, put them in handcuffs, and put them in the back of a squad car when they're already having potentially the worst day of their lives. And it could be substance abuse as well. That's the other thing I should add. These mental health centers are for people suffering mental health crisis and potential substance abuse as well.
We're talking to Representative Clint Moses right now, Republican from Menominee. He's one of the lead authors on a bill that would help create mental health crisis centers around the state. And Representative Moses, this bill does create a framework for the Department of Health Services to certify different centers. Is there a way to make sure that these are spread somewhat equally around the state where they're most needed?
Yeah, and I should add that there's still in the bill, it does require Department of Health Services to do a report to Joint Finance Committee as well. So there is some oversight, but you know, I gotta give a shout out to the Department of Health Services. You know, a lot of times you'll hear legislators that sometimes bash on the agencies, and yes, we have disagreements sometime, but I work very closely with Department of Health Services. I chair the Health, Aging, and Long-Term Care Committee in the Assembly. So it's important, you know, I can't just put bills out there and dictate and mandate things to the agency without finding out how it's going to affect them and what type of support they need. So it does leave a lot of room for rule promulgation from Department of Health Services. But like I said before, the bill specifies that these facilities must be 100 miles from Winnebago to start with. So the idea is to regionally place them. And I'm confident that the agency, along with guidance from Joint Committee on Finance, and rest assured, people like myself will be paying attention and watching this to see it. And I best describe it as like a pilot program, see how it works. And if it's successful, I think one will become two, will become five very quickly.
Yeah. And if it is successful, how do you envision funding going in the future? How do you envision it if it grows, you know, and it needs more money?
Well, and we had two sessions ago when that $10 million was allocated, the State Fiscal Bureau had come up with that number based on what I said before, which was facilities of 15 or less beds or residents that would be able to be there. And the other thing I should make sure I mention is that these facilities are intended for crisis, so 5-day maximums. Now, one of the things that was brought up in the public hearings that we had last week on this is what happens at the end of 5 days? Well, clearly, we're not just going to turn the person back out on the street. We're hoping that in that 5 days, if they were in one of these crisis centers, we've developed a plan. The mental health professionals have developed a plan and transition them back into the community and make sure that they get the support they need. The other advantage of these regional facilities is that it keeps the person closer to their family and hopefully whatever support system they have, rather than pulling them out of their community and sending them clear across the state.
And you have a handful of Republican co-sponsors on this. And in a minute, we're going to be talking with your Democratic co-sponsor. How do you feel about the support this has received so far? Are you feeling optimistic that this could pass?
I am. And, you know, I was proud to have a bipartisan bill passed last session as well. And I will say one of the things, and this is my sophomore session, that I do is I try to find what I can do that's going to help my district, my community, and the state as a whole that actually has a chance of passing. You know, I did a lot of the legwork. My office and Senator Markline's office did a lot of the legwork on this, along with Department of Health Services coming up with this bill and this plan. And then first thing we needed to do is find Democrats, people across the aisle that would also support it and see the value in it. So this is a bill that not only is fiscally responsible when you look at the cost to our communities, pulling law enforcement out, the cost to the family, the cost to the person that's going through the crisis, if you leave it undealt with, leave it untreated. And then also it's the right thing humanitarianly wise to do. It's the right thing to do to help these people get through the crisis and hopefully turn their life around. So, yeah, I'm proud to have bipartisan support. We've got a number of Democrats, a number of Republicans, both in the Assembly and in the Senate on this bill.
We'll leave it there for now. Representative Moses, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Republican Representative Clint Moses from Menominee. He talked with us earlier today about a bipartisan bill he introduced to create more mental health crisis care centers in Wisconsin. Now we're joined by one of the co-sponsors of that bill. Mark Spreitzer is a Democratic state senator from Beloit who represents Wisconsin's 15th Senate District. Senator Spreitzer, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So why is this bill important to you? Why did you sign on to it?
I've been hearing about this issue as long as I've been in the legislature, which is almost 9 years now, and I've been hearing about it from law enforcement folks who are concerned about the difficulty of transporting people several hours away to Winnebago. I've heard about it from family members of loved ones who have been in a mental health crisis and have really not had adequate resources, and there have been other bills in the past that I've supported that haven't become law, and so this is a slightly different approach that really feels like we might be on the cusp of actually moving the needle and getting something done here. And I had a chance to visit Winnebago Mental Health Institute earlier this spring, and it's an amazing facility that is incredibly necessary for people where that is where they need to go and the solution that they need. But really, you know, as Representative Moses was saying, if somebody's in that mental health crisis, first of all, we need a place where they can voluntarily check themselves in, which this bill also is aimed at providing, if they're willing to do that. And we need a place where they can be taken if necessary on an involuntary basis that doesn't require being put in a police car and driven for hours across the state. You know, that's not the environment somebody needs to be in for that amount of time when they're in a crisis.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about the situations where someone might be apprehended by the police while in a mental health crisis. But the vision for these centers is not only those circumstances. Is that correct?
Right. You know, I've talked to family members where, you know, their loved one was willing to check themselves in someplace voluntarily. They said, I need help. And sometimes it's really hard to figure out where to get that help if you need that inpatient kind of care. And so this is hopefully going to provide ultimately five more places around the state where when somebody says, I need help, they or their family members will have someone to call.
And it has not been all smooth sailing when it comes to mental health care funding between the parties in the state capitol. In the governor's last budget proposal, Republicans took some funding out of mental health. Why do you think this idea right now is getting some bipartisan traction?
You know, there has been bipartisan support for different versions of this in the past that just haven't gotten over the finish line. But I'm so glad that there are conversations between DHS and Republican legislators and that we have Democratic legislators supporting this as well. Because really, you know, we have to have the legislature and the administration working together. That really feels like it's happening in a meaningful way right now. And that's what gives this a chance at finally being successful.
Democratic State Senator Mark Spreitzer stays with us. He's the co-sponsor of a bill that would create more regional mental health crisis centers in Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Do you think it goes far enough? Is there more you want to see from the state legislature in terms of mental health care? If you have experience dealing with a mental health emergency for yourself or a loved one, what was that experience like? What would have helped in that moment? We'd love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Democratic State Senator Mark Spreitzer. He's with us today to talk about a bipartisan bill that would certify new care centers around the state for people going through mental health emergencies. We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the options that are currently available in Wisconsin? What more do you want to see in your area for mental health care? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Senator Spreitzer, we heard earlier from Representative Moses about working with the Department of Health Services on this, and this bill would create a framework for them to certify different centers as one of the options in a certain region. How important is it for you that they're heavily involved in this?
It's incredibly important. First of all, the governor has to sign any bill into law, and that means he needs to feel comfortable that the agency in charge of implementing it has the tools needed to implement it. And also, we want to make sure that these are facilities that are incredibly well regulated to protect patients who might end up there. And the Department of Health Services plays that role. They are also the department that runs the Winnebago Mental Health Institute that already exists. And so, they are the best position to be in this space. And we need to make sure they feel comfortable. And I'm glad that, they submitted extensive testimony in the public hearing on this bill. I understand they've been part of an amendment that is pending to make some technical changes. And so all of that really points to a good process here.
And when we talk about facilities here, centers, are we thinking about hospitals mostly, other type of centers? What do we have in mind?
So a hospital could be part of this. A county could take this on. I think we're open to, there are probably a couple of existing spaces that could work for this. But I think we're trying not to define that too narrowly, because as we look around the state to ultimately have five regional facilities, that may look different in different parts of the state as opposed, in terms of whether it's a county, a hospital, a nonprofit that steps forward and says, we're able to handle this.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Susie with us in Lodi. Hi, Susie.
Hi. Yeah, I happen to be listening in, and my family has suffered with mental health issues with people that we've loved. And basically, number one, you don't get help until you get arrested. Number two, you can't get pharmaceutical help, and you can't get counseling help. Someone that I love spent 10 years at the Mendota Mental Health Facility and did get aftercare, but had to have another crash and spent a week for $42,000 in a lockdown in La Crosse. So I would just say overall understanding healthy body, mind, and spirit, and we have no health care that's affordable in this country. Thank you.
Susie, thank you so much for calling and sharing that experience. Senator Spreitzer, what do you think about what Susie had to say?
Susie, that really rings true to me. And we do need to work on those community supports for folks. This is about that moment of crisis. But we need to make sure that when someone gets through that crisis, that they do have the ability to afford medications and counseling and things like that. And when I visited Winnebago this spring, we heard from a panel of patients there. And one of those patients was getting ready to be released back into the community and was talking about, her concern that she might end up back at Winnebago because she won't have the supports in place in the community to stay healthy. And so, this bill is part of the answer, but we can't stop here. We've got to do more.
Susie, thanks for that call. And Senator Spreitzer, we mentioned earlier that there's about $10 million in this bill attached to this project at this point. If this gets implemented and starts rolling along, are you concerned about funding in the future being perhaps a partisan issue, being a battle in the budget? What do you foresee?
There's always battles over funding in the state budget. I hope it's not a partisan battle. I would hope that in the future we'd come together and advocate for more funding as needed on a bipartisan basis. But I think the fact that there's been money set aside right now, let's get started and then let's see what we need to keep moving forward. We still have a $4 billion surplus left over after the last state budget. So $10 million is very small compared to that. If we need more, the money's available and I hope we can come together to provide it.
And what have you heard from your Democratic colleagues so far on the idea of this bill?
So we have a number of Democratic co-sponsors. All three of the state reps in my Senate district have signed on. I certainly think that we'd see strong Democratic support if this moves forward to a vote, which I hope it does.
Do you have a timeline in mind for when that might happen?
I don't set the calendar here, but I would hope sooner rather than later. We've got one more week in our fall legislative session. The Senate is scheduled to be in tomorrow and then a week from tomorrow, and the Assembly is on a similar timeline. So it would be great to get this through now, but if not, we'll be back in January, and I really hope we get it done then.
And is there anything else about this bill in particular that you really want folks to know or think that isn't getting talked about enough?
You know, going back to the law enforcement piece, you know, I have heard from police chiefs, sheriffs, individual patrol officers just about the fact that, you know, this is not something that they are well equipped to do in terms of involuntarily transporting people in crisis. You know, the shorter that transport can be, if it does have to be done, the sooner that a patient can be handed off to a medical professional. You know, that is what law enforcement's asking for. It's what patients are asking for. You know, then our local police can be back in our communities taking care of crime rather than having to spend hours on the road with somebody in their vehicle who really doesn't want to be there.
And then beyond emergency care and this bill, are there other things, Senator Spreitzer, that are on the top of your list when it comes to mental health care funding?
We've got to continue to focus on our youth, and you know, I'm glad that some of these facilities would ideally take youth who are in mental health crisis. But you know, we need to get youth access to counseling. We need to continue to work with our schools to make those mental health services available in schools. I know that's something Governor Evers has been pushing incredibly hard, and we didn't get as much done on that in this state budget as I would have liked to see. So that's really a top priority, especially you know, coming out of the pandemic, we've seen our youth having more and more challenges. And the more that we can help them get counseling and other services that they need when they're young, hopefully we don't, you know, get to a point where they're in crisis and actually need one of these facilities.
Well, Senator Spreitzer, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mark Spreitzer is a Democratic state senator from Beloit who represents Wisconsin's 15th Senate district. He was with us today to discuss a bill he's co-sponsoring in the Senate that would create new regional mental health crisis centers in Wisconsin. Earlier, we spoke with Republican representative and co-author of the bill, Clint Moses, to get his perspective. And as always, if you or a loved one is having thoughts of suicide, you can call or text 988 to reach the 24-hour National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's 988. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, the conservative group Americans for Prosperity is backing bills that would increase transparency and competition among Wisconsin's utility companies. Kate Archer-Kent talks with a member of the group about why it's an important issue for them, and we'll get different perspectives on how to manage the switch in owners in family businesses and protect their workers. That and more coming up tomorrow morning after 7 on The Morning Show. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a small, dead-end Wisconsin town is the setting for a new novel by UW-Whitewater professor Ken Broski. We're talking about what inspired the writing and what encouragement he has for us to develop our own writing style. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an update on the life of a Cuban Wisconsinite who lives in La Crosse. He's featured on the podcast WPR Reports, Uprooted.
Ernesto Rodriguez came to Wisconsin in the summer of 1980. That's after making a treacherous journey on a fishing boat from Cuba to the United States. Quickly after arriving on shore, Erne was shipped off to Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin. And it's in the military base's kitchen that he got a crash course in American food from a local cook.
One day he said, "Are you guys like macaroni and cheese? What the hell is macaroni and cheese?"
Erne has come to love mac and cheese and burgers. But as he first told us in the podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted, he also still cooks traditional Cuban food, like congri and chicken fricasse. Erne has embraced life in Wisconsin, but has never let go of his Cuban roots. He's lived between two worlds, only able to walk in one of them, the U.S. He's dreamed of returning to Cuba for a visit.
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is go to my hometown, see if I recognize where I used to live, and then spend the time with my family in Florida.
Erne has been a permanent resident of the U.S. for decades, but he wasn't able to become a citizen due to paperwork issues with his Cuban birth certificate. That means he couldn't vote or get a U.S. passport to travel. That is, until fall 2023. Ernesto Rodriguez traveled to Minnesota, where he took part in a naturalization ceremony.
All right, if everybody can please raise your right hand, and you're going to repeat after me. I hereby declare.
After reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, Erne received his certificate of naturalization. He was beaming.
Yeah, American citizen. I'm happy. I'm excited. You know, it's big, big step.
He waited more than 40 years for this moment.
I feel released now because now I can vote. Now I can apply to be Lacroix mayor.
He may be joking about running for mayor, but he's very serious about getting to vote. Erne grew up in Cuba and has only just become a U.S. citizen. He's in his mid-60s, and he's never voted in an election.
In 40 years I've been here, I have a sixth president, Jimmy Carter, Reagan, Bush.
He keeps up with politics in the news, so this is a huge deal to finally be able to participate in the democratic process. As for Erne's other lifelong dream, going back to visit Cuba, now that he can actually do it, he has some mixed feelings.
The only way I can go to Cuba is the whole government thing is throw away, throw to the garbage. If Cuba be free, this I can go there.
Erne is wary of the Cuban government. He misses his family, but even his sister discourages him from visiting. It's partially because he's been speaking out against the government and communism.
Cuba, you say, I don't like Castro, and there's people watching you. And they put you in prison for no reason.
Standing proudly next to Erne is Michelle Pinzel. They've been close friends for nearly two decades, so this day is emotional for her, too.
It's just incredible to see how patient and how diligent Ernesto has been in all of these years.
While Erne waits to vote and thinks about visiting Cuba, he has other things he wants to tackle first as a citizen.
Enjoying my life in a great country, America. Work to improve my life a little more and maybe buy a house and be a comedy, you know, stand comedy, make a joke.
But before he launches his stand-up comedy career, Erne is taking the day to celebrate. His first stop, lunch at a Cuban restaurant in the Twin Cities. His second stop, the Mall of America, so he can find a shirt or hat that features the U.S. and Cuban flags. To learn more about Erne's life in Cuba and Wisconsin, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted at WPR.org/uprooted. Big thanks to Mark Rickers for recording the audio for this story in Minneapolis. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, there's a lot that can go wrong when we think we know what's best for other people. Hubris is at the heart of a new horror novel from our next guest, a Wisconsin writer and professor, and he wanted to explore taking that idea to an extreme and supernatural level. We're going to talk about some of the themes from his new book and where he's drawing inspiration, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think small towns lend themselves to settings in works of fiction? Is it a setting that you like when you find it in a book? And are you a horror fiction fan? What do you like about reading books from that genre? What are some of your favorites? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ken Broski is an associate professor of English at UW-Whitewater. His latest novel is called What Doesn't Kill You. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thanks. And you are a member of the Horror Writers Association. You contribute regularly to genre publications. What do you like so much about reading and writing in the horror genre?
I like to be scared. That's one of the first things for sure that always sticks out with me. And I think also, I think we're sort of, this has been written about a couple of times recently, but we're definitely in sort of like a golden age of horror literature. There's so many different ways of writing it that authors are exploring, and they're coming up with some really interesting stuff. I tend to be more of like a classic horror writer compared to my contemporaries, but for me especially, this idea that horror can stand in for other things, I think, makes it a really interesting avenue to explore. And also, I like monsters, so that's always a plus, too.
Monsters are fun, yeah. What do you think makes for a really good fictional horror work, whether it's a short story or a novel? What makes for good, scary fiction?
You know, I think, you know, and I tell my students this a lot, I think the starting point really needs to be making sure that the writer knows about the conventions of horror so that they don't end up writing something that feels very generic or falls into a lot of tropes and cliches. I think once you know those elements of horror, I think you can really go above and beyond what people normally think of as horror. There's a lot of writers right now who like to write scary stories that involve how the body changes, for example. And that's always like a really interesting concept to explore from a horror perspective, because, I mean, let's face it, adolescence can be pretty horrific when you don't know what's going on with your body. And so there's a lot of writers exploring that. But I think for me especially, I start by thinking about what is scary, and then moving beyond that into thinking about, well, what scares the people that I want to write about?
Sure. And your latest writing is the book, What Doesn't Kill You. I want to turn to that and talk about, first off, the setting. It is the fictional Wisconsin town of Seven Sisters, Wisconsin. Can you talk to us a little bit about what it's like there in Seven Sisters?
So Seven Sisters is this classic small town that has sort of lost its luster as the result of a new road project that went in. And so it sort of went overnight from being right on this major highway route to sort of being like just a side road of a major highway route that moved. So it's got, you know, it has this one place of employment, which is the local grain depository. And then, you know, beyond that, it really is this town that's sort of just fallen into disrepair as the result of, the economic imbalance that occurs when, you know, when a town basically has this meaningful economic shift. And so it's a really great location for a scary story, because what ultimately happens in the book very early on is that the town essentially gets snowed in during this pretty heavy blizzard. And because the town is, everybody who lives in the town is so close to one another, it almost feels like, as I was imagining it in my head, it almost felt like this sort of like closed Hollywood set. And so I could picture, I actually drew the entire town on a piece of paper just to keep my head straight. And it was so easy to picture because it was basically this one main road that used to be a highway. And on one side of the road, you've got this grain mill located next to a railroad track. You've got a bar. You've got a little sort of all-purpose general store. And then on the other side of the old highway, you've got this horseshoe-shaped road where all the houses are on. And so as I was sort of like imagining the things happening in the story, I could always go back to that picture. And I was always reminded of, like, you know, just how isolated some small towns have become, especially if those towns are off the beaten path.
We're talking with Ken Broski right now, associate professor of English at UW-Whitewater and author of the new horror novel, What Doesn't Kill You? We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Have you started writing some fiction of your own? How's it going? What's working? What isn't? And do you have a favorite horror novel you want to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. We continue our talk with Ken Broski, professor of English at UW-Whitewater. We're talking about his new horror novel, What Doesn't Kill You, set in a small fictional Wisconsin town. And Ken, I got to say, I think you nailed the small Wisconsin town setting. Having grown up in one myself, a lot of the details were ringing true. Things I've heard people say, observations I've seen people make. I also loved the energy, because chapter by chapter, you're bouncing around to different places and different people, but they all kind of know each other, which I think makes it feel a little more intimate. How does that everybody knows everything aspect, how did that figure into the storytelling here?
You know, it's funny. None of that really came in the first draft of the story. I think in the first draft of the story, I was really just trying to get, I knew I wanted this monster to exist in the story. I knew kind of why I wanted all of that stuff to happen. And then as I was sort of going through the revision process, I'm one of those writers who spends a lot of time going back and rereading and then making changes and then going back and making changes. And so for me, like layering that town history and trying to get a sense of how each person would know the other people in the town was really useful, actually. And it didn't come all at once. It sort of was this process. I was really inspired by, I went back and rewatched a TV miniseries called Storm of the Century based on a screenplay by Stephen King. And the TV show is kind of funny because it doesn't really, it's kind of goofy sometimes, but at the same time, it was also like a really good examination of a small town living under duress. And so those kinds of stories helped give me a sense of just how much these characters needed to know about each other. And so as I was building it out, you know, piece by piece, family by family, it actually got easier as I was doing it because I started to know the characters better and I started to know exactly what they would do in that situation. So that was my approach with the town as a whole.
And why did you want to explore hubris as a main theme in this horror story?
I had this idea. I had seen this picture of this statue, and there was a beehive that had been, you know, bees had built this beehive on the statue's head. And I was like, wow, this is a really scary image. And then I didn't think of it for a while. And then I had a horrible nightmare about this beehive statue chasing me, which, you know, I woke up and I was like, wow, that was really scary. I should write something about that. So that was kind of like the start. But then as I was sort of thinking about like, well, why do I want this to exist in this small town? I started to pay more careful attention to social media in general. And one of the things that has started to like really stand out, the more I've been reading about social media, like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and TikTok, is that the people who create those programs that get us addicted, they always think about what's best, what they think is what's best for us, right? They think they know what we want. They think they know what we will like. And that's why those algorithms sort of get us addicted to social media so easily, is because they've essentially designed this process for telling us what we want and, you know, thinking about what they know best about us is more important than what we think we know best. And so I took that idea and I sort of implemented in this small town setting. And then I threw in a scary monster because, you know, I mean, it's a horror novel. It's got to have a scary monster in it. And I don't know. I constantly think about that a lot, this idea that if we are, you know, if we're going to spend so much of our time on social media and the people running it always are making decisions because they think they know what's best for us, what kind of world does that create?
We're talking with Ken Broski, Associate Professor of English at UW-Whitewater, author of the new book, What Doesn't Kill You. Ken, I also wanted to get your thoughts on some writing inspiration for us. And with that in mind, I want to go to the phones right now. We have Jim with us in Juneau. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
You bet. Yeah, what do you want to bring up?
Well, first, there's actually two things. I've had this book in my head since I was a little kid, and I'm in my 50s now. So I wanted to know what kind of advice you could give for the getting off my ass, sorry, and just putting pen to paper. How do you go about doing that for yourself? Second, I would like to know, mine also is based on kind of a science fiction-ish topic, and so how do you keep from falling too much into that niche? How can you make it relatable?
Gotcha. Jim, thanks for the questions. Sure. What do you think, Ken?
So, Jim, I'll give you a couple of ideas as a starting point. I think one thing you probably want to start with is thinking about the inciting incident. In other words, you know, take your main character, and before you write anything, jot down what a normal day in the life of your main character looks like, and then think about what is the inciting incident that is going to get, that is going to change your main character's life. And once you have that inciting incident, you can sort of leap into the story you want to write. I think one of the best things to start with when it comes to like how to figure out how to tell the story is remember the three magic words of storytelling. And the three magic words are therefore, however, and meanwhile. Okay. And therefore is one of the most important words because everything in your story, whatever you decide to tell in your story, should have purpose. There should be a reason it's being told. And so that's why in a lot of stories you see writers skip entire days. That's why in some stories you see, you know, writers will fast forward an hour, or they might say something like the main character had dinner and then went out, right? And they don't mention the dinner itself because it's not important to the story, right? So the word therefore is really important because it'll keep your mind focused on what's important in the story itself. And then however is where you throw a wrench in the gears of whatever's happening. So anytime you want to ramp up the tension, you use the word however as sort of like that key word in your head that tells you that something unexpected needs to happen to your main character and they need to react to that. And then you need to think about how that affects the story, right? So for example, if you watch the original Star Wars, you have the two droids who land on Tatooine at the beginning of the original Star Wars. The however for them was getting caught by the Jawas and then getting sold to Luke Skywalker. And then, of course, Luke Skywalker deciding he doesn't want to go with Obi-Wan Kenobi. However, when he returns home, his aunt and uncle have been killed by the Empire, right? So that word becomes super meaningful. And then the word meanwhile, you can use to jump from chapter to chapter. Meanwhile is kind of like this opportunity for you to cut to a new scene in your head as you're telling the story. With sci-fi, this is especially important because readers don't need to get bogged down with the world building too much with sci-fi. They want to jump right into the story. So think about your main character's life. What is going to throw them out of balance? What is going to be that inciting incident and how do they react to it?
Jim, thanks for the call. And Ken, thanks for that advice. We love to ask authors when they're on with us what they are reading. A little bit of a lightning round right now for you. Let's start with the horror genre. What's your recommendation right now for readers to pick up?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, you got to read What Doesn't Kill You because sell some books. Yeah, or my publisher is going to break my thumbs. But in terms of horror, I read another really good book called Boys in the Valley. It's by an author named Philip Fracassi. And it's kind of like the best way to describe it is Lord of the Flies meets The Exorcist. And so that's my horror recommendation beyond, and of course my book, obviously. But I got some other ones. Should we do some other genres too?
We've just got about 1 minute left. How about mystery?
Okay. Mystery. I would say definitely read Blacktop Wasteland by S.A. Cosby. He's a fantastic author. It's one of the best mysteries I've read in a long time. And if you have Audible or if you have a Libby subscription, definitely pick up the audio version because the narrator is fantastic.
And real quick, an all-time book recommendation.
I would say definitely Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. It's one of my favorite books. It takes a little bit of extra effort to follow. But once you get the hang of it, I think you'll be in for just an amazing fantasy, sci-fi, mystery, humor. It's got everything. It's my favorite book of all time.
Ken, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ken Broski is an associate professor of English at UW-Whitewater and author of the new novel, What Doesn't Kill You?